Chapter 15. A word pressed itself into Volyova's skull as hard and searing as a cattle brand. Ilya. She could not speak, could only shape her own thoughts in response.
Yes. How do you know my name?
I've come to know you. You've shown such interest in me, in us, that it was difficult not to know you in return.
Again she moved to hammer on the door that had sealed her inside the cash weapon, but when she tried to lift her arm, nothing happened. She was paralyzed, though still able to breathe. The presence, whatever it was, continued to feel as if it was directly behind her, looking over her shoulder.
Who?
She sensed a terrible mocking delight in her own ignorance.
The controlling sub-persona of this weapon, of course. You can call me 17. Who else did you think I was?
You speak Russish.
I know your preferred natural language filters. Russish is easy enough. An old language. It hasn't changed much since the time we were made.
Why now?
You have never reached this deeply into one of us before, Ilya.
I have.
Nearly.
Perhaps, but never under quite these circumstances, never with so much fear before you even began. You are quite desperate to use us, aren't you? More than you've ever been before.
She felt, despite still being paralyzed, a tiny easing of her terror. So the presence was a computer program, no more than that. She had simply triggered a layer of the weapon's control mechanism that she had never knowingly invoked before. The presence felt almost preternaturally evil, but that, and the paralysis, was obviously just a refinement of the usual fear generation mechanism. Volyova wondered how the weapon was talking to her. She had no implants, and yet the weapon's voice was definitely speaking directly into her skull. It could only be that the chamber she was in was functioning as a kind of high-powered inverse trawl, stimulating brain function by the application of intense magnetic fields. If it could make her feel terror, Volyova supposed, and with such finesse, it would not have been a great deal more difficult for it to generate ghost signals along her auditory nerve, or, more probably, in the hearing center itself, and to pick up the anticipatory neural firing patterns that accompanied the intention to speak.
These are desperate times.
So it would seem. Who made you?
There was no immediate answer from 17. For a moment, the fear was gone, the neural thrall interrupted by a blank instant of calm, like the drawing of breath between agonized screams.
We don't know.
No?
No, they didn't want us to know.
Volyova marshaled her thoughts with the care of someone placing heavy ornaments on a rickety shelf.
I think the conjoiners made you. That's my working hypothesis. And nothing you've told me has led me to think it might need reconsidering.
It doesn't matter who made us, does it? Not now.
Probably not. I'd like to know for curiosity's sake, but the most important thing is that you're still capable of serving me.
The weapon tickled the part of her mind that registered amusement.
Serving you, Ilya? Whatever gave you that impression?
You did what I asked of you in the past.
Not you, specifically, 17. I never asked anything of you. But whenever I asked anything of the other weapons, they always obeyed me.
We didn't obey you, Ilya?
No.
No.
We humored you. It amused us to do what you asked of us. Often that was indistinguishable from following your commands, but only from your point of view. You're just saying that.
No. You see, Ilya, whoever made us gave us a degree of free will. There must have been a reason for that. Perhaps we were expected to act autonomously, or to piece together a course of action from incomplete or corrupted orders. We must have been created to be doomsday weapons, you see. Weapons of final resort. Instruments of end time. You still are.
And are these end times, Ilya?
I don't know. I think they might be. You were frightened before you came here, I can tell. We all can. What exactly is it that you want of us, Ilya?
There's a problem you might have to attend to.
A local problem?
In this system, yes. I'd need you to deploy beyond the ship, beyond this chamber, and help me.
But what if we decide not to help you?
You will. I've looked after you for so long, taking care of you, keeping you safe from harm. I know you'll help me.
The weapon held her suspended, stroking her mind playfully. Now she knew what a mouse felt like after the cat had caught it. She felt that she was only an instant away from having her spine broken in two. But as abruptly as it had come, the paralysis eased. The weapon still imprisoned her, but she was regaining some voluntary muscle control.
Perhaps, Ilya, but let's not pretend that there aren't complicating factors.
Nothing we can't work around. It will be very difficult for us to do anything without the cooperation of the other one, Ilya, even if we wanted to.
The other one?
The other entity that continues to exert a degree of control over us. Her mind dwelled on the possibilities before she realized what the weapon had to be talking about.
You mean the captain?
Our autonomy is not so great that we can act without the other entity's permission, Ilya, no matter how cleverly you attempt to persuade us.
The captain just needs persuading, that's all. I'm sure he'll come around in the end.
You have always been an optimist, haven't you, Ilya?
No, not at all. But I have faith in the captain.
Then we hope your powers of persuasion are up to the task, Ilya.
I do too.
She gasped suddenly, as if she had been stomach-punched. Her head was empty again, and the horrid sense of something sitting immediately behind her had gone, as abruptly as a slamming door. There was not even a hint of the presence in her peripheral vision. She was floating alone, and although she was still imprisoned in the weapon, the feeling that it was haunted had vanished. Volyova gathered her breath and her composure, marveling at what had just happened. In all the years she had worked with the weapons, she had never once suspected that any of them harbored a guardian sub-persona, much less a machine intelligence of at least high gamma-level status, even possibly low to medium beta level. The weapon had scared the living daylights out of her, which, she supposed, had undoubtedly been the intended effect. There was a bustle of motion around her. The access panel, in a totally different part of the wall than she remembered, budged open an inch. Harsh blue light rammed through the gap. Through it, squinting, Volyova could just make out another space-suited figure.
Guri! Thank God, you're still alive. What happened?
Let's just say my efforts to reprogram the weapon were not an unqualified success, shall we, and leave it at that.
She hated discussing failure almost as much as she hated the thing itself.
What? You gave it the wrong command or something?
No. I gave it the right command, but for a different interpreter shell than I was actually accessing.
But that would still make it the wrong command, wouldn't it?
Volyova turned herself around until her helmet was aligned with the slit of light.
It's more technical than that. How did you get the panel open? Good old brute force. Or is that not technical enough?
Curry had wedged a crowbar from her suit utility kit into what must have been a hair fine joint in the weapon's skin, and then levered back on that until the panel slid open.
And how long did you take to do that?
I've been trying to get it open since you went inside, but it only just gave way right this minute.
Volyova nodded, fairly certain that absolutely nothing would have happened until the weapon decided it was time to let her go.
Very good work, Curry. And how long do you think it will take to get it open all the way?
Curry adjusted her position, reattaching herself to the weapon so that she could apply more leverage to the bar.
I'll have you out of there in a jiffy. But while I've got you there, so to speak, can we come to some agreement on the thorn issue? Listen to me, Curry. He only barely trusts us now. Show him this ship, give him even a hint of a reason to begin to guess who I am,
and you won't see him for daylight. We'll have lost him, and with him the only possible means of evacuating that planet in anything resembling a humane manner. But he's even less likely to trust us if we keep finding excuses for why he can't come aboard. He'll just have to deal with them.
Volyova waited for a response, and waited, and then noticed that there no longer appeared to be anyone on the other side of the gap. The hard blue light that had been coming from Kuri's suit was gone, and no hand was on the tool.
"Kuri," she said, beginning to lose her calm again.
"Ilya!"
Kuri's voice came through weakly, as if she were fighting for breath.
"I think I have a slight problem."
"Shit!"
Volyova reached for the end of the crowbar and tugged it through to her side of the hatch. She braced herself and then worked the gap wider, until it was just wide enough for her to push her helmet through. In intermittent flashes, she saw Kuri falling into the darkness, her suit harness tumbling away from her. Crouched on the side of the weapon, she also saw the belligerent lines of a heavy construction servitor. The mantis-like machine must have been under the captain's direct control.
"You vicious bastard! It was me who broke into the weapon, not her!"
Kuri was very distant now, perhaps halfway to the far wall. How fast was she moving? 3 or 4 meters per second, perhaps. It was not fast, but her suit's armor was not designed to protect her against impacts. If she hit badly... Volyova worked harder, forcing the hatch open inch by painful inch. Dully, she realized that she was not going to make it in time. It was taking too long. Kuri would reach the wall long before Volyova freed herself.
"Captain, you've really done it now."
She pushed harder. The crowbar slipped from her fingers, whacked the side of her helmet, and went spinning into the dark depths of the machine. Volyova hissed her anger, knowing that she did not have time to go searching for the lost tool. The hatch was wide enough to wriggle through now, but to do so she would have to abandon her harness and life support pack. She could survive long enough to fend for herself, but there would be no way to save Kuri.
"Shit," she said. "Shit, shit, shit."
The hatch slid open. Volyova climbed through the hole and kicked off from the side of the weapon, leaving the servitor behind. There was no time to reflect on what had just happened, except to acknowledge that only 17 or the captain could have made the hatch open. She had her helmet drop a radar overlay over her faceplate. Volyova rotated and then got an echo from Kuri. Her fall was taking her through the long axis of the chamber, through a gallery of menacing stacked weapons. Judging by her trajectory, she must have already glanced against one of the monorail tracks that threaded the chamber.
"Kuri, are you still alive?"
"I'm still here, Ilya."
But she sounded as if she had been hurt.
"I can't stop myself." "You don't have to. I'm on my way."
Volyova jetted after her, zooming between weapons that were both familiar to her and yet still quietly mysterious. The radar echo assumed definition and shape, becoming a tumbling human figure. Behind it, looming closer and closer, was the far wall. Volyova checked her own speed relative to it, 6 meters per second. Kuri could not have been moving much slower than that. Volyova squirted more thrust from her harness, 10, 20 meters per second. She saw Kuri now, gray and doll-like, with one arm flopping limply into space. The figure swelled. Volyova applied reverse thrust in incremental stabs, feeling the frame creak at the unusual load it was being expected to distribute. 50 meters from Kuri. 40. She looked in a bad way. A human arm was definitely not meant to articulate that way.
"Ilya, the wall's coming up awfully fast."
"So am I. Hold on. There may be a slight..."
They thumped together.
"Impact."
Mercifully, the collision had not thrown Kuri off on another trajectory. Volyova held on to her by her unharmed arm, just long enough to unwind a line and fasten it to Kuri's belt and then let her go. The wall was visible now, no more than 50 meters away. Volyova braked, her thumb hard down on the thruster toggle, ignoring the protestations from the suit sub-persona. The line tethering Kuri extended to maximum tautness, Kuri hanging between her and the wall. But they were slowing. The wall was not rushing towards them with quite the same sense of inevitability.
Are you all right? Valyova asked. I think I may have broken something. How did you get out of the weapon? When the machine flicked me off, the hatch was still nearly shut. I managed to get it open a little wider. But I had some help, I think. The captain? Possibly. But I don't know if it means he's fully on our side after all. She concentrated on flying for a moment, keeping the tether taut as she swung around. The pale green ghosts of the 33 cache weapons loomed on her radar. She plotted a course through them back to the airlock. I still don't know why he set the servitor on you, Valyova said. Maybe he wanted to warn us off rather than kill us. As you say, he could have killed us already. Just possibly he prefers to have us around. You're reading a lot into one hatch. That's why I don't think we should count on the captain's assistance, Kuri. No? There's someone else we could ask for help, Valyova said. We could ask Sylvest. Oh, no. You met him once before, inside Hades. Ilya, I had to die to get inside that fucking thing. It's not something I'm going to do twice. Sylvest has access to the stored knowledge of the Amarantin. He might know of a suitable response to the inhibitor threat, or at the very least have some idea of how long we have left to come up with one. His information could be vital, Anna, even if he can't help us in a material sense. No way, Ilya. You don't actually remember dying, do you? And you're fine now. There were no ill effects. Kuri's voice was very weak, like someone mumbling on the edge of sleep. You fucking do it, if it's that easy. Presently, and not a moment too soon, Valyova saw the pale rectangle which marked the airlock. She approached it slowly, winding Kuri in and depositing her, first, into the lock. By then the injured woman was unconscious. Valyova pulled herself in, closed the door behind them, and waited for the lock to pressurize. When the air pressure had reached 9/10 of a bar, she wrenched her own helmet off, her ears popping, and flicked sweat-drenched hair from her eyes. The biomedical displays on Kuri's suit were all in the green. Nothing to worry about. All she had to do now was drag her to somewhere where she could get medical attention. The door into the rest of the ship irised open. She pushed herself towards it, hoping she had the strength to haul Kuri's dead weight along behind her.
Wait.
The voice was calm and familiar, yet it was not one she had heard in a long time. It reminded her of unspeakable cold, of a place where the other crew members had feared to tread. It was coming from the wall of the chamber, hollowly resonant.
Captain, she said. Yes, Ilya. It's me. I'm ready to talk now.
Skade led Felka and Remontoir down into the bowels of Nightshade, deep into the realm of influence of her machinery. By turns, Remontoir started to feel light-headed and feverish. At first he thought it was his imagination, but then his pulse started racing and his heart thundered in his chest. The sensations worsened with every level that they descended, as if they were lowering themselves into an invisible fog of psychotropic gas.
Something's happening.
The head snapped around to look at him, while the ebony servitor continued striding forwards.
Yes, we're well into the field now. It wouldn't be safe for us to descend much further, not without medical support. The physiological effects become quite upsetting. Another 10 vertical meters, then we'll call it a day. What's going on?
It's a little difficult to say, Remontoir. We're within the influence of the machinery now. And the bulk properties of matter here, all matter, even the matter in your body, have been changed. The field that the machinery generates is suppressing inertia. What do you think you know about inertia, Remontoir?
He answered judiciously. As much as anyone, I suppose. It isn't something I've ever needed to think about. It's just something we live with.
It doesn't have to be. Not now.
What have you done? Learned how to switch it off?
Not quite, but we've certainly learned to take the sting out of it.
Skade's head twisted around again. She smiled indulgently. Waves of opal and cerise flickered back and forth along her crest, signifying, Remontoir imagined,
the effort that was required to translate the concepts she took for granted into terms a mere genius could grasp.
Inertia is more mysterious than you might think, Remontoire.
I don't doubt it.
It's deceptively easy to define.
We feel it every moment of our lives, from the moment we're born. Push against a pebble and it moves. Push against a boulder and it doesn't, or at least not very much. By the same token, if a boulder's rushing towards you, you aren't going to be able to stop it very easily. Matter is lazy, Remontoire. It resists change. It wants to keep on doing whatever it's doing, whether that's sitting still or moving. We call that laziness, inertia. But that doesn't mean we understand it. For 1,000 years we've labeled it, quantified it, caged it in equations, but we've still only scratched the surface of what it really is. And now? We have an opening, more than a glimpse. Recently the Mother Nest has achieved reliable control of inertia on the microscopic scale.
Exordium gave you all that?
Felker asked, speaking aloud. Skade answered without speaking, refusing to indulge in Felker's preferred mode of communication.
I told you that the experiment gave us a signpost. It was almost enough to know that the technique was possible, that such a machine could exist. Even then it still took us years to build the prototype.
Remontoire nodded. He had no reason to think she might be lying.
From scratch?
No, not entirely. We had a head start.
What kind of head start?
He watched mauve and turquoise striations pulse along Skade's crest.
Another faction had explored something similar. The Mother Nest recovered key technologies relating to their work. From those beginnings, and the theoretical clues offered by the Exordium messages, we were able to progress to a functioning prototype.
Remontoire recalled that Skade had once been involved in a high-security mission into Chasm City, an operation that had resulted in the deaths of many other operatives. The operation had clearly been sanctioned at inner sanctum level. Even as a closed council member, he knew little other than that it had happened.
You helped recover those technologies, Skade. I understand you were lucky to get out alive.
The losses were extreme. We were fortunate that the mission was not a complete failure.
And their prototype?
For years we worked to make it into something useful. Microscopic control of inertia, no matter how conceptually profound, was never of any real value. But lately we've had one success after another. Now we can suppress inertia on classical scales, enough to make a difference to the performance of a ship.
He looked at Felker, and then back to Skade.
Ambitious, I'll give you that.
Lack of ambition is for baseline humans.
The other faction, the one you recovered the items from, why didn't they make the same breakthrough?
He had the impression that Skade was framing her thoughts with extreme care.
All previous attempts to understand inertia were doomed to failure because they approached the problem from the wrong standpoint. Inertia isn't a property of matter as such, but a property of the quantum vacuum in which matter is embedded. Matter itself has no intrinsic inertia.
The vacuum imposes inertia?
It isn't really a vacuum, not at the quantum level. It's a seething foam of rich interactions, a broiling sea of fluctuations, with particles and messenger particles in constant existential flux, like glints of sunlight on ocean waves. It's the choppiness of that sea which creates inertial mass, not matter itself. The trick is to find a way to modify the properties of the quantum vacuum, to reduce or increase the energy density of the electromagnetic zero-point flux, to calm the sea, if only in a locally defined volume.
Remontoire sat down. I'll stop here, if you don't mind.
I don't feel well either,
Felker said, squatting down next to him.
I feel sick and lightheaded.
The servitor turned around stiffly, animated like a haunted suit of armor.
You're experiencing the physiological effects of the field. Our inertial mass has dropped to about half its normal value.
Your inner ear will be confused by the drop in inertia of the fluid in your semicircular canal.
Your heart will beat faster. It evolved to pump a volume of blood with an inertial mass of 5% of your body. Now it has only half that amount to overcome, and its own cardiac muscle reacts more swiftly to the electrical impulses from your nerves. If we were to go much deeper, your heart would start fibrillating. You would die without mechanical intervention. Remontoir grinned at the armored servitor. Fine for you, then. It wouldn't be comfortable for me either, I assure you. So what does the machine do? Does all the matter within the bubble have zero inertia? No, not in the present operating mode. The radial effectiveness of the damping depends on the mode in which we're running the device. At the moment, we're in an inverse square field, which means that the inertial damping becomes 4 times more efficient every time we halve our distance to the machine. It becomes near infinite in the immediate proximity of the machine, but the inertial mass never drops to absolute zero. Not in this mode. But there are other modes. Yes, other states, we call them, but they're all very much less stable than the present one. She paused, eyeing Remontoir. You look ill. Shall we return up ship? I'll be fine for now. Tell me more about your magic box. Skade smiled, as stiffly as usual, but with what looked to Remontoir like pride. Our first breakthrough was in the opposite direction, creating a region of enhanced quantum vacuum fluctuation, thereby increasing the energy-momentum flux. We call that state one. The effect was a zone of hyper-inertia, a bubble in which all motion ceased. It was unstable, and we never managed to magnify the field to macroscopic scales. But there were fruitful avenues for future research. If we could freeze motion by ramping inertia up by many orders of magnitude, we'd have a stasis field, or perhaps an impenetrable defensive barrier. But cooling, state two, turned out to be technically simpler. The pieces almost fell into place. I'll bet they did. Is there a third state? Falka asked. State three is a singularity in our calculations that we don't expect to be physically realizable. All inertial mass vanishes. All matter in a state three bubble would become photonic, pure light. We don't expect that to happen. At the very least, it would imply a massive local violation of the law of conservation of quantum spin. And beyond that, on the other side of the singularity, is there a state four? Now we're getting ahead of ourselves, I think. We've explored the properties of the device in a well-understood parameter space, but there's no point in indulging in wild speculation. How much testing, exactly? Nightshade was chosen to be the prototype, the first ship to be equipped with inertia suppression machinery. I ran some tests during the earlier flight, dropping the inertia by a measurable amount, enough to alter our fuel consumption and verify the effectiveness of the field, but not enough to draw attention. And now? The field is much stronger. The ship's effective mass is now only 20% of what it was when we left the mother nest. There's a relatively small part of the ship projecting ahead of the field, but we can do better than that simply by increasing the field strength. Skade clapped her hands together with a creak of armor. Think of it, Remontoir. We could squeeze our mass down to 1% or less, accelerate at 100 g. If our bodies were inside the bubble of suppressed inertia, we'd be able to withstand it too. We'd reach near-light cruise speed in a couple of days, subjective travel between the closest stars in under a week of ship time. There'd be no need for us to be frozen. Can you imagine the possibilities? The galaxy would suddenly be a much smaller place. But that's not why you developed it. Remontoir climbed to his feet. Still light-headed, he steadied himself against the wall. It was the closest he had come to intoxication in a great while. This excursion had been interesting enough, but he was now more than ready to return up ship, where the blood in his body would behave as nature had intended. I'm not sure I understand, Remontoir. It was for when the wolves arrive, the same reason you've built that evacuation fleet. Sorry. Even if we can't fight them, you've at least given us a means of running away
very, very quickly.
Clavain opened his eyes from another bout of forced sleep. Cool dreams of walking through Scottish forests in the rain seduced him for a few dangerous moments. It was so tempting to return to unconsciousness, but then old soldierly instincts forced him to snap into grudging alertness. There had to be a problem. He had instructed the corvette not to wake him until it had something useful or ominous to report, and a quick appraisal of the situation revealed that this was most emphatically the latter. Something was following him. Details were available on request. Clavain yawned and scratched at the now generous growth of beard that he sported. He caught a glimpse of himself in the cabin window and registered mild alarm at what he saw. He looked wild-eyed and maniacal, as if he had just stumbled from the depths of a cave. He ordered the corvette to stop accelerating for a few minutes, then gathered some water into his hands from the faucet, cupping the amoeba-like droplets between his palms, and then endeavored to splash them over his face and hair, slicking and taming hair and beard. He glanced at his reflection again. The result was not a great improvement, but at least he no longer looked feral. Clavain unharnessed himself and set about preparing coffee and something to eat. It was his experience that crises in space fell into two categories: those that killed you immediately, usually without much warning, and those that gave you plenty of time to ruminate on the problem, even if no solution was very likely. This, on the basis of the evidence, looked like the kind which could be contemplated after first sating his appetite. He filled the cabin with music, one of Quillenbach's unfinished symphonies. He sipped the coffee, leafing through the corvette's status log entries while he did so. He was pleased but not surprised to see that the ship had operated flawlessly ever since his departure from Skade's Comet. There was still adequate fuel to carry him all the way to Circum-Yellowstone space, including the appropriate orbital insertion procedures once he arrived. The corvette was not the problem. Transmissions had been received from the mother nest as soon as his departure had become evident. They had been tight-beamed onto him, maximally encrypted. The corvette had unpacked the messages and stored them in time sequence. Clavain bit into a slice of toast. Play 'em. Oldest first. Then erase immediately. He could have guessed what the first few messages would be like. Frantic requests from the mother nest for him to turn around and come home. The first few gave him the benefit of the doubt, assuming, or pretending to assume, that he had some excellent justification for what looked like a defection attempt, but they had been half-hearted. Then the messages gave up on that tack and simply started threatening him. Missiles had been launched from the mother nest. He had turned off his course and lost them. He had assumed that would be the end of it. A corvette was fast. There was nothing else that could catch him, unless he turned to interstellar space. But the next set of messages did not emanate from the mother nest at all. They came from a tiny but measurable angle away from its position, a few arc seconds, and they were steadily blue-shifted, as if originating from a moving source. He calculated the rate of acceleration, 1.5 Gs. He ran the numbers through his tactical simulator. It was as he'd expected. No ship with that rate of acceleration could catch him in local space. For a few minutes he allowed himself to feel relief, while still pondering the point of the pursuer. Was it merely a psychological gesture? It seemed unlikely. Conjoiners were not greatly enamored of gestures. "Open the messages," he said. The format was audio-visual. Skade's head popped into the cabin, surrounded by an oval of blurred background. The communication was verbal. She knew that he would never allow her to insert anything into his head again. "Hello, Clavain," she said. "Please listen and pay attention. As you may have gathered, we are pursuing you with nightshade. You will assume that we cannot catch you, or come within missile or beam weapon range. These assumptions are incorrect. We are accelerating and will continue to increase our acceleration at regular intervals. Study the Doppler shift of these transmissions carefully, if you doubt me." The disembodied head froze, vanished. He scanned the next message originating from the same source.
Its header indicated that it had been transmitted 90 minutes after the first. The implied acceleration was now 2.5 Gs.
Clavain, surrender now and I guarantee you a fair hearing. You cannot win.
The transmission quality was poor. The acoustics of her voice were strange and mechanical, and whatever compression algorithm she had used had made her head seem fixed and immobile, only her mouth and eyes moving. Next message, 3 Gs.
We have redetected your exhaust signature, Clavain. The temperature and blue shift of your flame indicates that you are accelerating at your operational limit. I want you to appreciate that we are nowhere near ours. This is not the ship you knew, Clavain, but something faster and more deadly. It is fully capable of intercepting you.
The mask-like face contorted into a stiff, ghoulish smile. But there is still time for negotiation. I'll let you pick a place of rendezvous, Clavain. Just say the word and we'll meet on your terms. A minor planet, a comet, open space. It doesn't bother me in the slightest.
He killed the message. He was certain that Skade was bluffing about having detected his flame. The last part of the message, the invitation to reply, was just her attempt to get him to betray his position by transmitting.
Sly Skade, he said, but unfortunately I'm a hell of a lot more sly. But it still worried him. She was accelerating too hard, and although the blue shift could have been faked, applied to the message before it was transmitted, he sensed that, in that respect at least, there had been no bluff. She was coming after him with a much faster ship than he had assumed available, and she was gaining ground by the second. Clavain bit into his toast and listened to the Quirrenbach a bit longer.
Play the rest, he said.
You have no more messages, the Corvette told him. Clavain was studying news feeds when the Corvette announced receipt of a new batch of messages. He examined the accompanying information, noting that there was nothing from Skade this time.
Play them, he said cautiously.
The first message was from Remontoir. His head appeared bald and cherubic. He was more animated than Skade, and there was a good deal more emotion in his voice. He leant towards the lens, his eyes beseeching.
Clavain, I'm hoping you'll hear this and give it some thought. If you've listened to Skade, then you'll know that we can catch you up. This isn't a trick. She'll kill me for what I'm about to say. But if I know you at all, you'll have arranged for these messages to be wiped as soon as you play them. So there's no real danger of this information reaching enemy hands. So here it is. There's experimental machinery on Nightshade. You knew Skade was testing something, but not what. Well, I'll tell you. It's a machine for suppressing inertial mass. I don't pretend to understand how it works, but I've seen the evidence that it does with my own eyes. Felt it, even. We've ramped up to 4 Gs now, though you'll be able to confirm that independently. Before very long, you'll have parallactic confirmation from the origin of these signals, if you weren't already convinced. All I'm saying is it's real. And according to Skade, it can keep suppressing more and more of our mass.
He looked hard into the camera, paused, and then continued.
We can read your drive flame. We're homing in on it. You can't escape, Clavain, so stop running. As a friend, I beg you to stop running. I want to see you again, to talk and laugh with you.
Skip the next message, he said, interrupting. The Corvette obliged. Felker's image replaced Remontoir's. Clavain experienced a jolt of surprise. The matter of who would pursue him had never been entirely settled in his mind, but he could have counted on Skade. She would make sure she was there when the killing missile was launched, and she would do all in her power to be the one to give the order. Remontoir would come along out of a sense of duty to the Mother Nest, emboldened by the conviction that he was executing a solemn task, and that only he was truly qualified to hunt Clavain.
But Felker?
He had not expected to see Felker at all.
Clavain, she said,
her voice revealing the strain of talking under 4 Gs.
Clavain, please. They're going to kill you. Skade won't go to any great trouble to arrange a live capture, no matter what she says. She wants to confront you, to rub your nose in what you've done.
what I've done, he said to her recording. And while she'll capture you if she can, I don't think she'll keep you alive for long. But if you turn around and surrender and let the Mother Nest know what you're doing, I think there might be a hope. Are you listening, Clavaine?
She reached out and traced shapes across the lens between them, exactly as if she were mapping his face, relearning its shape for the thousandth time.
I want you to come home safe and sound, that's all. I don't even disagree with what you've done. I have my doubts about a lot of things, Clavaine, and I can't say I wouldn't have...
She lost whatever thread she was following, staring into infinity before refocusing.
Clavaine, there's something I have to tell you. Something that I think might make a difference. I've never spoken of this to you before, but now I think the time is right. Am I being cynical? Yes, avowedly. I'm doing this because I think it might persuade you to turn back. No other reason than that. I hope you can forgive me.
Clavaine clicked a finger at the Corvette's wall, making it drop the volume of the music. For a heartbreaking moment there was near silence, Falca's face hovering before him. Then she spoke again.
It was on Mars, Clavaine, when you were Galliana's prisoner for the first time. She kept you there for months and then released you. You must remember what it was like back then.
He nodded. Of course he remembered. What difference did 400 years make?
Galliana's nest was hemmed in from all sides. But she wouldn't give up. She had plans for the future, big plans, the kind that involved expanding the numbers of her disciples. But the nest lacked genetic diversity. Whenever new DNA came her way, she seized it. You and Galliana never made love on Mars, Clavaine. But it was easy enough for her to obtain a cell scraping without your knowledge.
And? He whispered. Falca's message continued seamlessly.
After you'd gone back to your side, she combined your DNA with her own, splicing the two samples together. Then she created me from the same genetic information. I was born in an artificial womb, Clavaine, but I am still Galliana's daughter, and still your daughter, too.
Skip the next message, he said, before she could say another word. It was too much. Too intense. He could not process the information in one go, even though she was only telling him what he had always suspected, prayed, was the case. But there were no other messages. Fearfully, Clavaine asked the Corvette to spool back and replay Falca's transmission. But he had been much too thorough. The ship had dutifully erased the message, and now all that remained was what he carried in his memory. He sat in silence. He was far from home, far from his friends, embarked on something that even he was not sure he believed in. It was entirely likely that he would die soon, uncommemorated except as a traitor. Even the enemy would not do him the dignity of remembering him with any more affection than that. And now this, a message that had reached across space to claw at his feelings. When he had said goodbye to Falca, he had managed a singular piece of self-deception, convincing himself that he no longer thought of her as his daughter. He had believed it, too, for the time it took to leave the nest. But now she was telling him that he had been right all along, and that if he did not turn around, he would never see her again. But he could not turn around. Clavaine wept. There was nothing else to do.